Do you think there's too much money in politics? Well, campaign finance attorney Dan Backer thinks there's not enough, and he talks about it on this crummy little podcast.
Dan Backer is the founder and namesake of DB Capital Strategies, a political law firm. He's been a thorn in the side of the FEC for the past few years, most notably as plaintiff's counsel in McCutcheon versus FEC, the Supreme Court case, which struck down limits on the total amount an individual can give. But back before all of that, of course, he was the producer and co-host of Politics as Usual, a crummy little campus affairs radio show on the University of Massachusetts, where his co-host was yours truly. Dan Backer, thanks for coming full circle and joining this crummy little podcast.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me on. It's been, I guess, what now, 16, 17 years since we did radio together.
It is. It was the our first episode was, I think, the day after the Ken Starr indictment broke, when the special counsel had recommended to the House of Representatives that Bill Clinton be impeached. So that gives you a bit of a time frame on how long it's been since you and I had a conversation recorded for public distribution.
Yeah, and even then, and still now, we are fighting against Hillary, so who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, the more things change, the more things stay the same, right?
Yeah.
Dan, your specialty is in campaign finance, or what you're – this cycle we've got presidential candidates, most notably Bernie Sanders, are complaining about money in politics left and right. Every other phrase out of his mouth is millionaires and billionaires. There is a ridiculous amount of money being spent, raised and spent on campaigns today across the board. But you kind of think that's a good thing, right?
The only thing ridiculous about the amount of money we spend is that we don't spend way, way more. You know, the idea that the paltry, probably, $8 billion that we will spend in a two-year election cycle on all federal offices is somehow too much, pales in comparison to what we spend every year on Halloween. Every single year, we spend more money than that. Than we spend about $9 billion just on Halloween, on one day in our calendar, more than we spend an entire two-year election cycle. The candy part of Halloween alone is a $4 to $5 billion a year industry every single year. That's at least what we're spending on an annual basis on our politics. That is a terrible thing. I think we aren't spending nearly enough money. And I think the really crappy results that people feel they're getting from their legislators is a function of the quality of public discourse, because there's not enough money in it. We need money in order to run TV ads, run radio ads, make direct mailers, post things online, send emails, buy ads, hire staff, communicate ideas. Every dollar that goes into the political system serves one master, the conveyance of an idea. And it may come in a lot of weird ways and through different mediums. You have to have lawyers. You have to have communicators. You need staff. You need phones. You need all the things that you need. But it's always about conveying ideas. And the idea that we want to limit the amount of ideas that we should convey in deciding who's going to govern our system, I think contributes to the fact that we are nearing a $20 trillion deficit, or debt rather. We run, $750 billion to $1 trillion deficits in every single year of the Obama administration. Our economy is the slowest it's ever been, and our government is larger than it's ever been, and it's more intrusive in every aspect of our lives than it has ever been. And people are saying we're spending too much money trying to make sure the people we're electing to do this have the first clue what they're doing. I disagree. I think we need to spend vastly more money educating ourselves about the people that we elect.
So if you could snap your fingers and change our campaign finance system, what would that system look like?
Well, for starters, I think contribution limits are far, far too low. The biggest problem with campaign finance versus regulation is that it inherently benefits incumbents. There's really no way to regulate a system that isn't going to create tremendous advantages to the guy who's already in office, because he's raising money from day one for his next election, whether it's 2 or 4 or 6 years down the road. And any system that makes it hard for people to raise money is going to do that, make is disproportionately effective on people who are starting after that first day. And so our system benefits the incumbents and penalizes the outsiders. And then that creates a toxic environment. So the things that we need to do in our campaign finance system is remove the restraints, the barriers to entry for political outsiders. Right off the bat, raising contribution limits, I think, is hugely important, especially for the state party and local party infrastructure. In 2002, we passed the McCain-Feingold Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. What this did was a lot of bad things, but the thing that it did that is probably the most egregious is that it crushed the ability of state and local parties to participate in their own election. It defined federal election activity and limited the amount of money you could spend registering voters. It set extremely low caps on contribution limits for state and local parties when they're participating in federal elections. And frankly, it didn't index them for inflation, which means the $10,000 that you could give in 2002, which maybe it sounded like a lot then, is the same $10,000 you can give now, nearly 15 years later. And it's a shared limit between your state party and all your possible local parties. So these limits effectively function to radically reduce the ability of state and local parties to engage in politics. And I'll give you a great example. A mutual friend of ours, a guy that we went to college with, Paul Farrow, chairs a local party committee in Massachusetts, either Marlboro or Framingham. I think Marlboro.
It's Marlboro.
It's Marlboro. And he probably raises more money than any other political committee in Massachusetts except the state party. But he's always competing against the state party. So here's somebody who has actually been effective at electing Republicans. And people, I as a donor, have to decide who I'm going to give my very limited ration of speech to, of these two potential sources. Why do they need to compete with one another? Why can't I have as much speech as I want and help as many people speak as I want? I get the fact that this tends to be a question for large donors, but large donors are underwriting small donor speech every single day anyway. It is a fundamental nature of political speech. So I think right off the bat, you have to increase party limits. You have to repeal what's left of McCain-Feingold that hasn't been found unconstitutional. You have to stop, and this is crazy, you have to stop telling political parties they're not allowed to coordinate their ads with their candidates beyond a certain level. Parties exist to elect their candidates. So these restraints that don't let them do so and force them to create independent expenditure arms where they're running ads, but they're doing it through outside vendors that aren't talking to candidates, that's crazy. I think the reporting burdens and the disclosure burdens on committees and individuals they're more and more egregious, and they're getting worse every year because of the level of political activity. One trend you're seeing a lot more now, really in the last probably 2 to 4 years, started by Senate conservatives funded Act on the Right and Act Blue on the Left, were conduits, where they'll eat the credit card fees to raise money from a population of donors and forward it to candidates. But this makes FEC reporting extraordinarily burdensome, and for no good reason. And so you're magnifying these burdens as people are finding new and interesting ways to engage grassroots. So in essence, to do something that benefits grassroots engagement and speech, our government makes that harder and makes it more burdensome to discourage it, because we'd much rather have $1,000 than $2,000 donors. So these are some of the immediate fixes. But writ large, the major issue is government needs to stop regulating political speech. It needs to get out of the business of deciding how much you can talk and how you can talk and when you can talk and with whom and at what volumes and at what times and wearing what color hat and what reports you have to file based on the amount of money and the time of the election cycle. All of this burden has had absolutely no practical impact on the thing that people complained about, money in politics. In fact, we get more and more money every single cycle. Instead of trying to control people's political speech, our government ought to find a way to effectively monitor it for clear illegality, which is not that complicated to do, and then do its best to promote grassroots engagement by lifting these burdens off speech. That is not your 30-second short answer, by the way.
Well, if we were looking for 30-second short answers, we'd be on terrestrial radio again, right?
Yeah.
This is a deeper dive. Now, you mentioned specifically the restrictions on party giving, which seems like it's had an additional effect in weakening not just state and local parties, but political parties writ large. You know, it seems like that the Republican Party infrastructure and the Democratic Party infrastructure have both taken a back seat to whichever candidates come out, that it's a much more personality-driven enterprise.
I don't know that that's a function of the campaign finance system so much as our cult of personality media obsession. I mean, our culture is really driven by personality these days. And I don't say this to mock the Kardashians. you know, look at the Kardashians. You know, there's almost no redeeming value to anything involving them, but yet they're TV shows, but yet they're incredibly popular. You know, Donald Trump is a great example of this. He has made, he gets probably about, you know, millions of dollars every single day of free media because he's running. He has spent less on his race than almost anybody in politics. I think the year end he had, he'd made a $12 million loan. He'd raised $6 million from the general public. He'd only spent a couple million dollars on his election. And that includes candidate, you know, the money that he's personally spending on himself. So, you know, he doesn't need to spend the money because he already has that personality and he's able to acquire that free media. And in this political environment, in this media environment, that media awareness is the most valuable thing in terms of getting elected. You're not going to win if people don't know who you are. And everybody knows who Donald Trump is. So I think that's had a real impact. And I don't think it has all that much to do with campaign finance. I will say that limits on the national parties in terms of what they can raise was a bigger problem before 2004, the end of 2014, when we suddenly had the creation of these new party super accounts. Up until right now, the general rule is you can contribute $32,400 to any state, or sorry, to any national party committee. Pre-McCutcheon, so before about April of 2014, you had this other limit on top of that, which basically said in a 2-year cycle, you could only give like $78,000. So you had about 2.5 committees worth of speech you were rationed between 3 committees over 2 years. Now McCutcheon knocks that out, and you can give $32,400 to each committee each year. And then in December of 14, you have this amendment passed to an appropriations bill, that one of the promnibuses. And this actually did a really great thing. The parties now each have these 3 new accounts, which have these super limits, 3 times the normal. So in this cycle, it's $97,200 per account. One is to run their conventions, which is good because you no longer have public financing of conventions, which itself is very good because we don't want public financing of political conventions. 2, you have a separate account for buildings. And let me tell you, I think state parties should have these accounts too, because the national party committees have their office headquarters, and these are large and increasingly expensive things to maintain. And so, but so do state parties. So I would actually like to see that extended out. And 3rd is the legal challenge fund, the recounts and funds. This is huge. Lawyers we're not cheap, and even the RNC and the national committees that have in-house counsel, when they're looking at doing multiple recounts and election contests, this isn't done by house lawyers. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars are going to get spent bringing in every available lawyer you can. You know, Bush v. Gore probably cost millions and millions of dollars. And so you're able to take money that was intended for free speech and use it for free speech instead of using it for these challenges. So I think that's been helpful. But the bigger problem, I think, the weakening of the party system and the party system of party discipline is the creation of outside poles of influence. The Koch brothers, George Soros, Heritage Foundation, when outside organizations are able to effectively engage with the grassroots, which is what they do. I mean, their function is they're able to engage voters on ideas and talk about which candidates support which ideas. That swings election outcomes. And it creates an opportunity for power plays outside of the party system. You can win election to the Senate, and not just the House, but the Senate, without being a party man. And you people tend to, you know, become a lot friendlier once they're in. But the reality is, when all the power isn't concentrated in a single place, when you're able to raise money, reach out to donors, communicate with voters, and there are people that are supporting that who are able to do those things for you as well, you find that you don't need to have the same level of party loyalty and discipline. People can have ideas that they believe in that aren't shared by the party. And I think that's been the story of the last 3 cycles. You saw it a little bit in 2010, a lot in 2012 and 2014, and it's going to be the story now. If I don't have to compromise my values in order to, you know, come up to a more squishy, mellow sense of Republicanism in order to, you know, gain the party support and be accepted and reach this audience, I'm not going to do it. And I don't think principled ideologues are going to do that. Instead, they're going to run on their principles, and they're going to be supported by organizations that want people with those principles in power, and is going to be supported by voters who want that because they're able to reach those voters. So the weakening of the party system is more a function of the advance of technology and a little bit Citizens United freeing them up to talk, but You know, they're not really doing anything too new. It really comes down to the ability to communicate effectively with broad audiences using internet and other technological innovations. So, yay tech.
You mentioned earlier about raising contribution limits, but you don't want to get rid of contribution limits completely.
So there is the understanding of and this is going to get into the legal argument a little bit, but political speech is subject to strict scrutiny, and contributions are not. They're subject to this somewhat heightened level, and it's not entirely clear what, of intermediate scrutiny. So they're afforded protection, but just a little bit less. And the level of the protection is essentially, and frankly, Citizens United really beat this up a little bit, but you cannot interfere with the way that people spend money in politics except to prevent actual or quid pro quo corruption or apparent quid pro quo corruption. And this is not a bad standard at all. And it's, in essence, they're saying you cannot use the campaign finance system to bribe people, which nobody wants. And you can't use the campaign finance system to do stuff that looks like you're bribing people, because that's equally bad. And I think there are jurists who would have an even tighter line. You can't do anything, period. But if we accept that the standard of law here is actual or apparent quid pro quo corruption, and you eliminated contribution limits, what you have is people cutting million-dollar checks. And the problem there is, I don't think people are going to be corrupted necessarily, but I don't think it passes the sniff test to say, I'm giving you, congressman, a million-dollar check. You're spending $1.1 million on this race. I'm giving you $1 million, and you're not somehow in my pocket. I think it creates too great an appearance of corruption if you don't have some kind of contribution limit. There are a lot of people, including in the Republican Party, who would disagree with me, but I do think, and certainly Sean McCutcheon thought, there has to be some kind of base limit, because otherwise you're just creating bribery. What that number needs to be, I think, is open to interpretation, and Congress gets to draw that line. The number, when they passed the original Campaign Finance Act in 76, you're talking about, I think it was a $1,000 contribution limit. Right now, I can give you $2,700. If you adjusted for inflation, $1,000, it would actually be close to like $40,000. I hate to say it, but $1,000 doesn't buy you jack in an election. You can't buy a district-wide donor file for that. You can only send so many emails. In fact, I can tell you by the prevailing email send rate of most commercial vendors that say, you're basically not going to be able to send more than 1 million emails for that $1,000. I mean, it's not a lot of money. You're not going to be able to run TV. You're not going to be able to run radio. You're not going to be able to hire staff to run, manage volunteers and recruit volunteers. You're not going to be able to pay for software. Money doesn't go as far as it used to in politics as in any other field, anywhere else in our economy. And so it takes a lot more money. And I do think it's valuable for people to have to raise money from a broad cross-section of society to show that level of support and that the adoption of the free market of their ideas. But I also don't think it's acceptable to say you have to raise it from so many people that it's almost impossible, and you have to spend all your time raising money in order to be able to compete politically. Everyone complains, from members on the Hill to outside organizations to people, whenever they hear about members of Congress spending 4 hours a day making fundraising calls. But you know what? They need the money. So your option is don't make those calls and lose, or raise the contribution limit so you can raise enough money in a transparent manner so you're able to run an effective campaign without spending 4 hours a day on the phone. The problem is, of course, that the vast majority of political money is still tends to be small dollars. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of problems in this entire system. But at the end of the day, you have to have a base limit of some kind. It just needs to be a lot higher. And I need to allow for candidates to spend and office holders to spend more time doing their job and less time fundraising. Not because we mandate it or we demand it, but because we create a system that is reasonable on its face.
We have a system now where just about every presidential candidate, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, has an associated super PAC that's helping them out. And Bernie Sanders has some super PACs helping him out, but he says he doesn't want their help.
Well, but he's got unions, and that's the same thing but different.
Exactly. So as you're looking at these super PACs, they're not just doing – 2 years ago, you saw these super PACs. 4 years ago, you saw these super PACs, and they would do they would take on TV, which is the most expensive piece of a campaign's budget. Now you're seeing them get into polling, getting into door-to-door,
yeah,
and things of that nature. But there's no contribution limits on those, and you can have someone write, you know, multi-million dollar checks and essentially help get someone elected without having those contribution limits. Does that hurt the process there? Does that create does that fail that sniff test that you talked about?
I don't think that it fails the sniff test. I think it is a very natural process. You know, let's say somebody's running for office where you live, and you know, you give them some money, but you really like them. You know, are we saying that you can only be supportive of them if you go through the campaign, that you're not allowed as an individual to go out and support him in other ways? Of course not, because that's unconstitutional. It infringes on your right to freely speak about the people that you want to elect. You know, for whatever reason that you want to speak about them, and in whatever way you want to speak about them, it's your right to do so. Not just because you do it through the campaign-approved mechanism. Your rights are not subordinated to the rights of the campaign. And if you want to do it and a bunch of other people want to do it and they want to spend money on it, well, this is all fine. And of course it's natural. The thing that drives me nuts is this idea that the money is in politics, that the money in politics is going to be solved by more government. The reason the money is in our political system to the extent that it is because government is in our lives to the extent that it is. And if you really want to get money out of our political system, get our government, our political system, out of our lives and out of our money, and you take away the market incentive for it to be there in the first place. People have a right to talk about the government and the people that they're sending to run that government that is influencing every aspect of their lives, that is trying to micromanage and interfere with everything we do on a human level. Of course people have a right to do whatever they want to influence that government that is trying to impact them and impact their friends and their families and their kids and their grandkids and their neighbors. It is the most appropriate use of people's time to engage in outside political speech, not merely through the campaigns. And if you want to do it and I want to do it, there's nothing that should reasonably prevent us from doing it together in the form of a political committee. You know, the reason you form super PACs is you're required by law when you're two people trying to do something together to form a committee. It's not like an optional thing. You know, I could, if God willing, I had $1 million and to run on TV, I could do it by myself. And I don't have to create a political committee. I still have to file an independent expenditure report. But if I want to do it with you together, we each had $1 million, I'm sure we both love that, to do this. Now all of a sudden we're a political committee and we have all these additional reporting requirements. It's the law that requires the formation of the entities in order to promote transparency. And I think it's essential that we have these outside groups, because you and I talking about the issues that we care about are going to be different than whatever the campaign wants to talk about, than whatever the opposition wants to talk about, whether in the primary or in the general. People should not be restricted in their ability to freely talk about the issues they want to talk about with whatever money they want to talk about it with. And the idea that, you know, somehow it's a bad thing because super PACs are created to support these candidates, you know, it's voluntary contributions. It's a hell of a lot better than the government taking money from me and giving it to candidates, which is always what Democrats, whose ideas suck in the free market, they keep pushing public financing. That's what they want. I like a system where I get to decide who I want to support and how I want to support them and can spend as much or as little as my money as I do. You know, I love the Halloween analogy for the amount of money, but it's a great analogy for everything in politics. You know, on my street, you know, we got lazy this year. We didn't put up any outside decorations. We had a bowl of candy and we kind of gave it out. Kids didn't even want to go trick-or-treat. Yeah, they're young. They like that. Guy next door to us, lights off, no candy, nothing. Did not participate. Next door after him, you know, they had decorations. It was nice. It was modest. You know, they had some decorations. They had some lights. They had better candy than we did. You know, that's their choice. They got to spend their money in the market, just like we spent, but just a little bit less. Guy in between us spent nothing. A couple doors down, guy goes crazy. He's like all into Batman. He turns his garage into the Batcave. He's riding around on his motorcycle, like they have tricked out as a Batmobile, as a Batbike. It's awesome. He spends a ton of money every single year on this, and it's his right to do so. Why do we have all this freedom when it comes to Halloween, and we can't have the same freedom when it comes to deciding who is going to govern our nation and decide the extent of the interference of that government in our lives? So I think the fact that there's these outside groups is a good thing. I think the fact that they're aligning up with individual presidential candidates is not unreasonable. people like these guys. They reflect their values. You know, candidates are really just proxies for the values we project in them more than anything else. I mean, hell, you know, I don't understand why people like Hillary Clinton, but clearly people are projecting ideas on her because the only thing she believes in is whoever cut the – whatever the guy who cut the last check told her to believe in. So, you know, so really it's the art of projection. I think it's fine. I think it's great that people are doing this. I think that we ought to have a lot more of it. I would rather have money in the hands of individuals outside the campaigns sharing their ideas about candidates than I would having the money inside the campaigns. I think candidates should be able to raise money, but you know, really isn't the – you know, I'm a free speech guy. I'm much more interested in the speech of everybody other than the candidates because I don't want to hear what you want to tell me about you as much as I want to hear what everybody else thinks about you. We ought to have a Yelp political system. You can write what you want, but everybody else gets their reviews.
That's all very intelligent. The thing I took away is, man, I got to go check out your neighborhood on Halloween. That's my main takeaway.
Oh yeah, it's a lot of fun over here.
That's Dan Backer. He's the founder of DB Capital Strategies, campaign finance expert, and I would say it's fair to say you're passionate about free speech. Is that a good characterization?
Absolutely. You know, I'm really lucky. I wake up every morning, get to go into my own office and fight for something that really matters and I really care about. It's a good day.
Dan Backer, thank you very much for joining this Crummy Little Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Thanks for listening to this Crummy Little Podcast. If you want to hear more, check out www.crummylittlepodcast.com. You can also subscribe on iTunes, and don't forget to leave a review. Thanks again.